We find ourselves in the very final episode of the book of Judges. So please open your Bible to Judges chapter 19. Judges chapter 19. And this is a story that's dark and difficult because these were days that were dark and difficult. And this twisted story of sin and civil war is so typical of the book that the author chooses to end with this story. Not a chronological appearance. This doesn't happen after the Samson material, but it's arranged topically, and I'll show you why that is, I think, as we study these chapters. The goal would be to finish these chapters, and I think it's important that I set them before you, chapters 19, 20, and 21, by reading them at the outset. So try to listen along, and I'll take a few moments to explain what's happening if anything's unclear. But God has a message for us in these three concluding chapters of the book of Judges, and I want to start by putting them before your ears. Judges 19, verse 1. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah, and his concubine was unfaithful to him. And she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and there was there some 4 months. And then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. He had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys, and she brought him into her father's house. When the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. And his father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and spent the night there. And on the fourth day, they arose early in the morning, and he prepared to go. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go." So the two of them sat and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Be pleased to spend the night, and let your heart be merry." And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law pressed him till he spent the night there again. And on the fifth day, he arose early in the morning to depart. And the girl's father said, "Strengthen your heart and wait until the day declines." And so they ate, both of them. And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold, now the day has waned toward evening. Please spend the night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here and let your heart be merry. And tomorrow you shall arise early in the morning for your journey and go home." But the man would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. And he had with him a couple of saddle donkeys, and his concubine was with him. And when they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, and the servant said to his master, "Come now, let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." And his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah." And he said to his young man, "Come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or Ramah." So they passed on and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, and they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. And behold, an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. The men of the place were Benjaminites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going? Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "We're passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remotest parts of the hill country of Ephraim, from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to the house of the Lord, but no one has taken me into his house. We have straw and feed for our donkeys, with bread and wine for me and your female servant and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything." And the old man said, Peace be to you. I will care for all your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square." So he brought him into his house and gave the donkeys feed. And they washed their feet and ate and drank. And as they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, surrounded the house, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house that we may know him. And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brothers, do not act so wickedly since this man has come into my house. Do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now. Violate them and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing. But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light. And her master rose up in the morning. And when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, get up, let us be going. But there was no answer. And then he put her on the donkey, and the man rose up and went away to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak. Then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, and the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And the chiefs of all the people of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword. Now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone up to Mizpah, and the people of Israel said, tell us, how did this evil happen? And the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, I came to Gibeah that belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine to spend the night. And the leaders of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house against me by night. They meant to kill me, and they violated my concubine, and she is dead. So I took hold of my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel, for they have committed abomination and outrage in Israel. Behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here. And all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, and none of us will return to his house. But now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot, and we will take men of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, and 100 of 1,000, and 1,000 of 10,000 to bring provisions for the people, that when they come, they may repay Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage that they have committed in Israel. So all the men of Israel gathered against the city, united as one man. And the tribes of Israel sent men throughout all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what evil is this that has taken place among you? Now therefore, give up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and purge evil from Israel. But the Benjaminites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the people of Israel. And then the people of Benjamin came together out of the cities to Gibeah to go out to battle against the people of Israel. And the people of Benjamin mustered out of their cities on that day 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who mustered 700 chosen men. Among all those were 700 chosen men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. And the men of Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All these were men of war. The people of Israel arose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God, who shall go up first for us to fight against the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up first. And then the people of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin. And the men of Israel drew up the battle line against them at Gibeah. The people of Benjamin came out to Gibeah and destroyed on that day 22,000 men of the Israelites. But the people, the men of Israel, took courage.
and again formed the battle line in the same place they had formed it on the first day. And the people of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening. And they inquired of the Lord, "Shall we again draw near to fight against our brothers, the people of Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Go up against them." And so the people of Israel came near against the people of Benjamin the second day. And Benjamin went against them out of Gibeah the second day and destroyed 18,000 men who drew the sword. Then all the people of Israel, the whole army, went up and came to Bethel and wept. They sat there before Yahweh and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before Yahweh. And the people of Israel inquired of Yahweh, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, ministered before it in those days, saying, "Shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease?" And Yahweh said, "Go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand." So Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah. And the people of Israel went up against the people of Benjamin on the third day and set themselves in array against Gibeah as at the other times. And the people of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. And as the other times, they began to strike and kill some of the people in the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel, from the other to Gibeah in the open country, about 30 men of Israel. And the people of Benjamin said, "They are routed before us, as at the first." But the people of Israel said, "Let us flee and draw them away from the city to the highways." And all the men of Israel rose up out of their place and set themselves in array at Baal Tamar. And the men of Israel who were in ambush rushed out of their place from Mareh Gabah. And there came against Gibeah 10,000 chosen men out of all Israel. And the battle was hard. But the Benjaminites did not know that disaster was close upon them. And Yahweh defeated Benjamin before Israel. And the people of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day. And all these were men who drew the sword. So the people of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. Now, in the following paragraph through verse 48 is a detailed account of that third battle, the battle where the Benjaminites were defeated. I'll read it for you. 36. So the people of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. The men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin because they trusted the men in ambush whom they set against Gibeah. And then the men in ambush hurried and rushed against Gibeah. The men in ambush moved out and struck all the city with the edge of the sword. Now the appointed signal between the men of Israel and the men in the main ambush was that they went and made a great cloud of smoke rise up out of the city. The men of Israel should turn in battle. Now Benjamin had begun to strike and kill about 30 men of Israel. They said, "Surely they are defeated before us as in the first battle." But when the signal began to rise out of the city in a column of smoke, the Benjaminites looked behind them, and behold, the whole of the city went up in smoke to heaven. And then the men of Israel turned, and the men of Benjamin were dismayed, for they saw that disaster was close upon them. Therefore they turned their backs upon the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness, but the battle overtook them. And those who came out of the cities were destroying them in their midst. Surrounding the Benjaminites, they pursued them and trod them down from Nohah as far as opposite Gibeah on the east. 18,000 men of Benjamin fell, all of them men of valor, and they turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. 5,000 men of them were cut down in the highways, and they were pursued hard to get them, and 2,000 men of them were struck down. So all who fell that day of Benjamin were 25,000 men who drew the sword, all of them men of valor. But 600 men turned and fled towards the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon, and remained at the rock of Rimmon 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back against the people of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword, the city, men and beasts, and all that they found, and all the towns that they found they set on fire. Now the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, "No one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin." And the people came to Bethel and sat there till evening before God, and they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, "O Lord, the God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel? that today there should be one tribe lacking in Israel. And the next day the people rose early and built their own altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the people of Israel said, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up in the assembly to Yahweh? For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. And the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin, their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel this day. What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives? And so solution number one is given in verse 8. They said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah? And behold, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. So the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men there and commanded them, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, also the women and the little ones. This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman that has lain with a male you shall devote to destruction. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. And then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead. But they were not enough for them. And the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. And now we see solution two to the Benjamites missing one third of the wives they needed. Verse 16, and the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for wives for those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin? And they said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe cannot be blotted out from Israel. Yet we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the people of Israel had sworn, cursed be he who gives a wife to Benjamin. And so they said, behold, there is the yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebonah. And they commanded the people of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in ambush in the vineyards and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances and then come out from the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, we'll say to them, grant them graciously to us, because we did not take for each man from them his wife in battle, neither did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty. And the people of Benjamin did so and took their wives according to their number from their dancers whom they carried off. And then they went and returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and lived in them. And the people of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. And they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Thus reads the word of the Lord. By the time you get to the end of that, it becomes hard to remember how this whole thing started. By the time you get to the solution for the perpetuance of the tribe of Benjamin, whittled down from a great number of warriors through the civil war that captures the middle chapter of these three chapters, the solutions given to come up with 600 wives in order to not break their oath and thus preserve the line of Benjamin. It's hard to remember where this all started, especially with the complexities of chapter 20. Chapter 20 is a historical battle scene recreated by the author, giving us a narrative account of the fight the revenge, the retribution of Israel for the rape. But it becomes not an easy battle at all. Three different battles, actually. The first two are won by Benjamin, and Israel suffers great loss. And repeatedly, they seek answers from Yahweh, and repeatedly he tells them, go up against them, go up against them, go up against them. And then finally, Israel defeats Benjamin in a gruesome battle and destroys them almost completely, leaving only 600 survivors. And it's hard to remember where this all came from, except if this first chapter, 19, weren't so shocking and graphic. And so the reason I want to treat these three chapters together, and the reason you need to consider them together, because they're one literary piece. Remember, Judges had two introductions in the opening chapters, and it closes with two conclusions. We looked at the first conclusion last week. Chapter 17 and 18 were the story of religious decline in Israel, that remarkable beauty of Israelite worship, their sacrificial system, some of the complexities of their dietary laws, all were things just looked at from the outside that remind us that Israel was a special people, a people who worshiped in a way unlike any other people. And to read the story of Judges 17 and 18 is to see the complete decline of Israelite religion. That the worship of Yahweh had fallen onto hard times, to say the least, as priests were now up for hire to the highest bidder. That the decisions they made weren't decisions from Yahweh, decisions but from greed and from malice. And what a mess Judges 17 and 18 was to show us religion in Israel in the period of the judges when there was no king in Israel. And now these final three chapters, in order for you to understand exactly what the message of the author of the book of Judges, the inspired author of the book of Judges, is trying to get across to us, is framed. Chapter 19, verse 1, in those days when there was no king in Israel. And then the final verse of the section, chapter 21, verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel. And then the amended line, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That formula that reminds the reader that there was no king in Israel in these days, that this was kingless days, that these were days that were governed and dictated not by a monarch and not by the human monarch that would come through Saul and then David, but also not through the divine monarch, God as king, as he was presented in the book of Judges, that ruler over his people, the divine king that made them even more different than other nations because God was their king, but he wasn't their king in any meaningful way in these dark days. And so our study of the book of Judges closes on these three chapters, and indeed they are distressing days, the days of the judges. Dark, awful, really difficult to read. And as we look at these three chapters, I think you'll see some familiar themes. And I think we can look at them chapter by chapter, just briefly, having read through it all, and help you to understand them, but most importantly, to take with you the message of the book of Judges. And so let's look at these three chapters as three parts, and we'll start with chapter 19, a very difficult chapter. And I'd like you to call it the sequel of the sin at Sodom. Chapter 19 gives us a sequel of the sin at Sodom. Chapter 19 is a depiction of depravity that sets in your mind at the outset the theme that he needs you to have. You're not going to see a lot of commentary from the author anywhere in the book of Judges. On rare occasions, he'll insert a judgment call, but there's nothing from the author in Judges 19, 20, and 21 that tells you what God thinks of this thing, except that opening and closing line. So with the words, in those days there was no king in Israel, we're introduced to a man. And then we remember this complex story that we just heard opens from just one Levite priest, one of those chosen sons of Aaron, not the same man that we met in 17 and 18, not Micah, not that household Levite that we met there, but a different Levite, same theme, different guy. This Levite from the same part of the country was an Ephraimite, is introduced to us, and he's a Levite who is already exceptionally set out to be one who is not a model citizen. He has himself a concubine, a slave wife. That's not an ideal setup for one who serves Yahweh and is supposed to be devoted to Yahweh. And they don't have a model marriage either, whether verse 2 is rendered, they were angry with each other or she was unfaithful to him. The best texts tell us she was unfaithful to him. This whole scene of national depravity began with one man's compromise. One man, the story begins, and then his concubine, and then the story shifts to the in-laws and the family, and then the story shifts to the town, and then the story shifts to that tribe and their crimes, and then the story shifts to the other 11 tribes of Israel, and then the chapter at the end, 21, is full of the phrase, as one man, as one man. So what began as this personal immoral tragedy and crime and sin breaks out in this massive ripple effect across these final three chapters to show you one of the lessons that we've seen in the book of Judges is that sin never stays contained. Sin is never personal only. Sin is never privatized. Remember, after reading all of that, this whole thing began in one man's house, in one man's life, in one man's relationship. And then it became a couple, and then it became a family, and then a city, and then a tribe, and then a nation, and then a civil war. And then kidnapping and everything else. I'm not sure there's an uglier chapter in all of the Old Testament. I told you this is the sequel to the sin at Sodom. Depravity on significant display. That story, as you know, is in Genesis chapter 19, actually. And in Genesis 19, at least the foul crowd in Sodom who's doing the same thing, banging against the door. And undoubtedly, the author of Judges 19 has that scene in mind as he recreates this scene from the same perspective, grabbing onto the same terminology, shoulder to the door, the sounds of the lustful crowd of Sodomites trying to break in to steal a visitor and women, innocent women being offered up instead. It's almost the same exact scene. But the main difference is that this is happening in Israel. Sodom was a completely foreign land. It was a town that had no righteous people in it, save Lot and his family, and their righteousness was certainly borderline. What I'm saying is that wasn't a covenant place. This is a covenant place. In fact, the irony is laid on as this story really belabors its point with the whole hospitality offer carrying on day after day after day, as if the author is showing us just how inevitable this tragedy was. Well, if only they would have stayed another day, or if they would have left early, or if this gregarious father-in-law wouldn't have sent them at that exact time, or if he would have listened to his servant, and why didn't they stay in Jerusalem? It wasn't called Jerusalem yet. It was called Jebus, and it was a Gentile town, but the Levite in this weird sentence of righteous commitment says, I won't stay in a foreign town. I'll press on to Gibeah or Ramah. But why didn't he choose Ramah? Why did he choose Gibeon? And so we see this dark course of events unfold, and we see these near opportunities to avoid this horrific tragedy, but it's not missed. And we're reminded that this is a sequel to the sin at Sodom. that sin every time we see it, and I think we see it everywhere here. I don't think there's a character who's not touched and marked by sin and its effects. Everyone here, from the hospitable old man who finally brings them in, and then an act of incredible cowardice offers his virgin daughter and the concubine of his house guest in order to protect his man. I don't think you can wrap this in, oh, how important was ancient Near Eastern hospitality? Look, if ancient Near Eastern hospitality was important, and it was, you would have protected everyone under your roof, not just this man. And so you see this sin unfold in an awful way, this dark, lurid scene as they're celebrating together, these new friends, this night in Gibeah, having met in the town plaza. And now the foul crowd beats on the door, just like Genesis 19. And they demand unspeakable activities with this house guest. And then we're introduced to what is an unforgettable, awful night of unspeakable terror, provoked by the cowardice both of her husband, the Levite, and of this hospitable man, as they throw her out to the foul crowd and she's dragged away. And the author describes this scene in such a sordid way. I can't get over that picture. In verse 27, her hands on the threshold when he rises up. The author presents the Levite husband with such callousness. Whether it was a fight or her infidelity that provoked this, the law would have given provision for both of those things. But whatever it was, and I don't think we can get too specific on what caused her to leave in the first place beyond infidelity, this man gave his wife to this crowd, and she was brutally attacked. And the author shows her hand. I mean, look at the detail there, her hand on the threshold. And then you see his callousness. And I think the author even reinforces this by no longer calling her husband, but instead using the Hebrew word Adonai, master, her owner, woke up or rose up. How did he sleep that night? And he opens the door, and in this vicious sentence in verse 28, he looks down at her near death and he tells her, get up, let's be going. And she doesn't answer. And so he throws her on the back of a donkey like baggage, like property. And then he makes this graphic decision to dishonor her remains in this way, in order to send a warning call throughout Israel. And before we see the effects of that warning call in chapter 20, just let 19 hit you. Because later prophets, men like Hosea, would speak of the days of Gibeah. They would speak of this night and these days as a solemn warning of the depth of the depravity of the hearts of the people of Israel. Hosea 9. Verse 9, Hosea 10, verse 9, he refers to the days of Gibeah, the days where this dark night happened, and there was no angels to blind this crowd that night. Yahweh's absence is palpable in this chapter. That he allows these people to experience the consequences of life without a king reminds us of how dangerous it is to live in the independence and autonomy of sin. For you to live in such a way that you choose to do what is right in your own eyes will oftentimes work out just fine. It will. You'll probably be solvent. Things may go well for you as you choose to follow your own desires and your own lusts and make your own decisions and dishonor God's word. But at other times, things will not go well for you. And in eternity, things will go very poorly for you if you follow after your own heart's desires. And some of you have sat through, roughly 100,000 sermons in the book of Judges we've had so far, roughly. And you have heard time and time again warnings about how sin will come back to you, how sin will repay you, how sin will never only affect you, how its ripple effects will go not just to you, but to those around you, those you claim to care about, those in your city, those in your nation. It will have a prevailing, exponential kind of effects. And yet to still do what you think is right instead of what God has said is right reminds us of what a blasphemous and rebellious cry of autonomy that sin is, a declaration of independence against God. And then we get to chapter 20, and we do see God in this chapter. It's marked by the sovereignty of God in civil war. I think the markers that make this very long chapter clear, and I think you understand, they all come together as one man. Look at verse 1, it says, as one man. Look at verse 8, it says, as one man. Look at verse 11, it says, as one man. One of the themes of the book of Judges is not unity of Israel. I mean, the tribes are a mess throughout this book. Remember when Gideon had to go toe-to-toe with the Ephraimites and they wouldn't battle with him? Do you remember when the sons of Judah, one of the tribes of Israel, handed over their deliverer, Samson, betrayed him? I mean, that's what the book of Judges has been like. The tribes don't get along. The tribes fight one another. And now in the ultimate act of unity, they decide that they will destroy one of their brothers. And this is not to say that there is a rightness or a wrongness in that decision. God told them to go up against them. God showed them the way they should go. Simultaneously, in their first two attempts, God punishes the ones he told to go. Some have read into this and said, well, they weren't really praying right, or they weren't really repentant, and that's why this section that says that they wept and fasted. But if you think that these people are repentant, I don't think you've read the book of Judges. They use Yahweh as some sort of divining tool. Should we go or should we not go? They're using him like a coin toss. But the sovereignty of God is on display throughout this entire book and throughout chapter 20 as he discerns exactly what he will do to show Israel what life is like without a king. And when they removed him from his throne, and to show Benjamin that there will be consequences for their actions. There is a rightness and a wrongness in every part of this chapter. You can't take a one-side view that says, well, Israel's in the right because God told them to go up against them, because that same Israel will now, in chapter 21, be far more concerned about breaking another oath than they are about stealing someone's daughter. What a mess. The sin that's on display in this chapter, the civil war as God's chosen people fight against one another and nearly exterminate one of their brothers entirely. I mean, there's such violence and such vehemence here as this crime is rightly punished upon these evildoers. They were given a chance to give up the people who did the crime, and they put them before them, and Benjamin send out the guilty, and they wouldn't listen to the voice of Israel, verse 13 of chapter 20. But still, how do we read this chapter? How do we read it? I mean, even the Levite gives such a selective presentation of what happened as he gives his kind of legal announcement before the gathering of Israel. That isn't exactly how it went down, by the way. We saw it. We saw her hand grasping the threshold. You're acting like you had no other choice. He didn't lay down his life for her. But now we have a civil war in our hands. And we see this great display of unity And the author sees it and pronounces it three times, as one man, as one man, as one man, a unity we never saw against the Midianites. A unity we never saw against the Philistines. Now they've found that unity against Benjamin, one of their own. And Benjamin receives exactly what he deserves. Because of the sin, they treat him like they were supposed to treat the pagan nations in the book of Joshua. They put a total ban on Benjamin, nearly. They burn his city. They kill the women, the children. God did not tell them to do that. That was what they did. He told them to go up against them. They chose to do it this way in that final third and successful battle. Because of the first two defeats, that leads in the sovereignty of God to the overconfidence of the Benjaminites. They come out their city, the Israelites feign running away. They come further out. An ambush party goes into the city, lights it on fire, destroys all the women and children, and then comes and crams into the Benjaminites as they flee. And as they go, they're slayed along the highways, only 600 left. And you see God in it. Verse 35 is the theological assumption here of chapter 20. Look what it says. Yahweh defeated Benjamin before Israel. Does that mean that God approves of the entirety of everything that's happened here? No. Does it mean that God disapproves of the entirety of everything happened here? No. Does it mean that God is sovereign over people's sin, over every dark and wicked night? The answer is yes. His sovereignty is on display because God has not yet given up on his people. And that takes us to chapter 21. And if it's the sequel to sin at Sodom in chapter 19 and the sovereignty of God in civil war in chapter 20, I think this is the sorrow of Israel in chapter 21 and the unshakable grace of Yahweh. What a moral fog this has been, right? And now that in 21, there's two concerns that drive this chapter, and it's presented in two poetic parallel parts. It's the concern about we can't let one of our brothers be exterminated completely, to die out. And you see the theme of sorrow in verse 2 and 3 of chapter 21. They lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And then you see it again in chapter 21, verses 6 and 7. They had compassion for Benjamin. One tribe is cut off from Israel. You see it again in verse 15 of chapter 21. The people had compassion on Benjamin. What shall we do for wives of those? But it's up against this vow. They made a vow to destroy them completely. They made a vow to all come up as one man, and any tribe that doesn't come up will be destroyed. And that's what happens to the tribe given in verses 8 through 12. Jabesh Gilead is exterminated. Their wives are stolen, but it's not enough. It's only 400. They're 200 short. So what are they going to do? What a mess. What a moral fog. What a disaster. You can't read this chapter and say, you know, I got some moral judgments to give on this thing. You would run out of time. Everything happening here is a mess. Everything happening here is a disaster. Everything happening here is a highlight of depravity. Even in the people's compassion for their brother tribe, they are being such an example of a people ruled by their own impulses. Even their compassion comes from their own hearts, not from the heart of God. But God's sovereignty overrules it all. I went to dinner once at an air traffic controller's house. At his house, not at the tower. And I just asked him. I'd never talked to an air traffic controller. I'd seen the movie Tin Cup. But is that the golf one or the airplane one? Anyway, so I knew very little, obviously, about air traffic control. And I was interested, and so he told me lots of stories, and then he gave me an old map. And I can't let this fall into the hands of the terrorists. So I don't know if I'm even supposed to have this or show it or whatever. But It looks like classified documents. It's spaghetti, right? It's lines all over the place. And that's the streets and the elevations up in the air where airplanes are supposed to fly. What a mess. How do we not run into each other all the time? There are thousands upon thousands of flights that happen just in the United States every day. And these air traffic controller guys tell the planes where to go. And they usually listen, except for April 1977. They weren't even up in the air. They were just on the taxiway in the Canary Islands, and the fog was really heavy. And one pilot of a 747 decided that he saw a clear path, but he didn't realize what the air traffic controller realized, that they were using that runway for a taxi purpose for another 747. And he blasted off right into the other plane, and 600 people were killed that day. That's what it's like when you don't see everything. When you only see what's in front of you and you don't have a higher perspective on life, a higher perspective on where everything is, and the people in this fog, this moral morass, are making decisions to kidnap wives for the perpetuation of the tribe of Benjamin. And you got to realize this is the book that would have been studied and read by the kings that would rule over Israel. And the lessons that they gained from this about the sovereignty of God were also lessons about their own theological and personal and ethnic heritage. They looked back at their life, at the call of Abraham, at the exodus of Moses, at these powerful moments of redemption, and they were constantly punctuated by sorrow and grief and disobedience and the consequences that God laid on them. And all of these things happened for those kings to realize that having a king was not enough, because when Yahweh was their king, these things still happened. What they needed was a godly king who'd give them God's perspective on things. And so the theological position of chapters 19, 20, and 21 is so muddled in this moral mess as these people show how one man's sin in one house expands to an entire nation. There's a line in a hymn that we sing sometimes that says, "He who thinks of sin but lightly." Is that you? Have you been tempted to think of sin but lightly? To justify your sin? To look at your sin and to coddle it rather than to confront it? To take your sin and put it up against, maybe Judges 19. Well, it doesn't seem bad as that sin. But all sin is an offense to a holy God, and all sin has its same root as the sin at Sodom and its sequel here in the book of Judges. We start to move away from this book, we realize that God's still in control. And after I read that line, that final line one more time, "In those days there was no king in Israel, everyone did what was right in his own eyes." I have to say, how is there still an Israel? And the answer is because of the tenacious and unfailing grace of God. He preserves these people. He still ministers to them. He still protects them. He still extends an offer of grace to them. And after all of these saviors, all of these deliverers have been raised up, the people are still in need of a deliverer. And they'll get kings, good and bad. And they'll get prophets who will speak the word of God to them. But a time will come when that ultimate deliverer will be there. And I hope you realize, as the people of the book of Judges, I pray, would realize, as the nation of Israel would realize in these days as they study their own spiritual history, they have to walk away saying, how desperately, even after a book of 12 deliverers, how desperately we still need a deliverer. Friend, you need a deliverer. You need a Savior, not an imperfect one, not a temporal one, but the eternal Son of God, the man Jesus Christ, the Lord who lived a perfect life and died on that Roman cross for the sins of all who would trust in him. That's the deliverer, the anticipated and expected deliverer that's prefigured and shadowed through all these imperfect ones who can take away your sin and transform you forever, to take your horrid sin, just as bad as the sin displayed here, upon himself and suffer the wrath of God in your place. That's ultimately how we see Jesus in the book of Judges. Because though there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in his own eyes, the eyes of God are upon these people. And he knew that he would have a lasting king to give to them. A king who would rule and reign over his people in perfection and eternity forever. King Jesus, our Lord and our deliverer. Father, thank you for your word. What an ambiguous situation of rightness and wrongness we've seen in these texts. And then we see you perfect in holiness, in opposition to sin and unrighteousness. And we know, God, that you ultimately stand in our way as a judge, that our sin prevents us from knowing you and understanding why we've been created. So you've made a way. Thank you for Jesus Christ. Thank you for the offering on the cross to pay for our sins. Help us to see the depth of sin's sorrow, your sovereignty under it all as you direct men and women to trust in Jesus, to the good news of the gospel. God, we know that your judgment is not too harsh, but your compassion is real. And it's up with your justice. So help us, God, to embrace the only solution to our sin, Jesus Christ, in his name. Amen.